Hello everyone, I'm Steve. I'm a volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona, and I'm going to be bringing you the Arizona Daily Star for today, Tuesday, the 28th of October, 2025. But I thought before we looked at the star this morning, we'd have a look at the synopsis that's given to us by the National Weather Service. This is what they have to say. Mostly sunny, dry, and warm conditions will prevail through the weekend. High temperatures will be several degrees above normal, except across eastern areas Wednesday into Thursday, when a dry backdoor cold front pushes in colder air from the east. Morning low temperatures Thursday morning will be close to freezing in the normally colder Sulphur Springs Valley. Gusty east winds prevail on Wednesday, especially for locales more exposed to easterly winds. There you have it. That's the weather forecast. Now, let's go ahead and turn to the star. These are the front page stories. New grazing rules could open more public lands to cattle. Trump to meet with Japan's new leader. And the California fight could turn on ads edge. And then finally, I'll read officials warn about changes in FEMA. Here we go. That first front page story. New grazing rules could open more public lands to cattle. And it opens with a picture. Cattle are moved toward a corral during spring 2024. Cattle roundup near Elgin, Arizona. It shows a gentleman on a horse and a field with a bunch of cows moving along. The Trump administration has announced plans to broadly reform the regulations on the ranching industry that could have a major impact on protected federal lands and endangered species in Arizona. On October 22nd, the leaders at the U.S. Department of Agriculture, Department of Interior, Department of Health and Human Services, and the Small Business Administration announced a series of federal actions they say will strengthen domestic ranching and lower beef prices. The plan includes opening vacant grazing allotments on federal public lands, streamlining the permitting process for ranchers seeking to utilize allotments, creating new evidence standards to compensate ranchers after wolf attacks, and reforms to endangered species protections. The Trump administration has been talking about these things separately. They haven't put them all in one package before, said Brian McGonnell. That's Brian DeGonnell, who's president of the Arizona Cattle Growers Association. DeGonnell said the nonprofit organization supports the plan and views the reforms as a positive step for the future of American ranching. If we have a problem, it's that this stuff's not getting implemented quickly enough, DeGonnell said. Environmental advocates say such sweeping changes to public lands policies could have major impacts on Arizona's landscapes and endangered species. It's a wasteful policy handout to the very small fraction of Arizona ranchers who benefit from public lands leases, to the detriment of everyone else in our state who depends on public lands for clean air and water, wildlife, outdoor recreation, and quality of life, said Greta Anderson, a deputy director at Western Watersheds Project, a nonprofit or a conservation organization, in a written statement. According to the USDA, the United States has lost more than 100,000 ranching operations, while consumer demand for beef has grown 9% in the past decade. The number of American cattle is at a 75-year low, according to the agency. America's food supply chain is a national security priority for the Trump administration. We are committed to ensuring the American people have an affordable source of protein and that America's ranchers have a strong economic environment where they can continue to operate for generations to come, said Agriculture Secretary Brooke Rollins in a news release. So that's a little bit of information, folks, on new grazing rules could open more public lands to cattle. Now, our next front page story, Trump to meet with Japan's new leader. President Donald Trump opened his visit to Japan on Monday with greetings from the Emperor, a day before he meets new Prime Minister Sanae Takaichi. That's Sanae Takaichi, who is banking on building a friendly personal relationship with the U.S. leader to ease trade tensions. One key to this strategy might lie in an idea floated by Japan's government to buy a fleet of Ford 150 trucks, a meaningful gesture that may also be impractical given the narrow streets in Tokyo and other Japanese cities. It's an entirely diplomatic test for Takaichi, the first woman to lead Japan. She took office only last week and has a tenuous coalition backing her. Trump instantly bought into the idea of Ford trucks as he flew to Asia aboard Air Force One. Quote, "She has good taste," unquote, Trump told reporters. Quote, "That's a hot truck," unquote. Japanese Emperor Naruhito welcomed Trump at the Imperial Palace after the president's arrival, and the two spoke for about 30 minutes. Trump straightened his jacket as he stood next to Naruhito for photos before sitting across a round table, I think it should read, with flowers in the middle for their talks. "A great man," he said twice while pointing to the emperor. Trump last saw the emperor in 2019, soon after Naruhito ascended the chrysanthemum throne, becoming the first foreign dignitary invited to the palace. Trump and Takaichi spoke over the phone while the president was mid-flight on Saturday. Takaichi stressed her status as a protege of the late Prime Minister Shinzo Abe, a favorite of Trump's from his first term, and said she praised him for brokering the Gaza ceasefire that led to the return of hostages held by Hamas. "I thought Trump is a very cheerful and fun person," she said. "He well recognizes me and said he remembers me as a politician whom former Prime Minister Abe really cared about," she said. So that's a little bit, folks, on Trump to meet with Japan's new leader. Next, California fight could turn on ad's edge. Well, the fight over new California U.S. House maps that could erase up to 5 Republican seats is starting to look like a lopsided matchup, with opponents running low on campaign ads and options. While the dynamics of the race could still change, and ballot questions have a history of quirky outcomes in California, industry data show TV advertising spending, the main pipeline voters use in a vast state, by Republicans and other critics of the proposal dropped off dramatically. The map pushed by Democratic Governor Gavin Newsom aims to bolster his party's chances of regaining a House majority in 2026 and counter Republican efforts to add more GOP seats in other states. Voting began this month and continues through its conclusion on November 4th. More than 1.5 million Democratic mail ballots were returned so far, outpacing about 853,000 Republican ballots. though that's not surprising in a state where registered Democrats outnumber GOP voters by nearly 2-1. Data compiled by advertising tracker Ad Impact show Democrats and other supporters booked nearly $9 million in ad buys on broadcast TV, cable, and radio. But opponents have virtually no time reserved, though the data don't include some popular streaming services like Hulu and YouTube or mail advertising. So that's a little bit of information, folks, on the California fight could turn on ads' edge. And then finally, on the front page, officials warn about changes at FEMA. Now, you know, FEMA is the Federal Emergency Management Agency or Administration. And it says here, state officials on the front lines of preparing for natural disasters and responding to emergencies say severe cuts to federal security grants, restrictions on money intended for readiness, and funding delays tied to litigation are posing a growing risk to their ability to respond to crises. It's all causing confusion, frustration, and concern, and the federal government shutdown is making it worse. Every day we remain in this grant purgatory reduces the time available to responsibly and effectively spend these critical funds, said Kiele Amundsen. That's Kiele Amundsen, communications director at the Hawaii Emergency Management Administration. The uncertainty has led some emergency management agencies to hold off on filing vacant or on filling vacant positions and make rushed decisions on important training and purchases. Experts say the developments complicate state-led emergency efforts, undermining the Republican administration's stated goals of shifting more responsibility to states and local governments for disaster response. So there you have it, folks. Those are the front page stories. New grazing rules could open more public lands to cattle. Trump to meet with Japan's new leader. California fight could turn on ads edge. And then finally, officials warn about changes at FEMA. Okay, time to go now to the local news. And we find that on page 15. Okay, local news this morning in the Tucson and Region section of the Star opens with Arizona's EV charging network moving forward. It opens with a picture here. State transportation officials are moving ahead with a three-phase build-out plan designed to close gaps in charging access along major interstate and state highway corridors across Arizona. And the picture shows an electric vehicle being recharged at a charging station. So Arizona's plan to build more than 70 electric vehicle charging stations along state highways is moving forward after months of delay, with the first stations expected to be operational in 2026. The move is coming months after a federal court order restored $76.5 million in frozen federal funding. The Arizona Department of Transportation submitted an updated expansion plan to federal authorities in September after completing a public input period that closed September 8th. The agency had finalized contracts for 18 stations in August 2024, but was forced to put the project on hold when federal funding was suspended in February. The agency expects to launch a second solicitation this fall for 34 additional stations along state highways, said Garen Groff, an ADOT spokesman. ADOT's current plan, now under federal review, proposes a third phase, adding approximately 21 stations on 9 new corridor segments, including Arizona 77 from Tucson North to the Pima County line. The Federal Highway Administration has not specified a timeline for completing its review. If federal approval comes through and Phase 2 solicitation proceeds this fall as planned, the full network could be operational by 2028, establishing reliable fast-charging access along Arizona's major travel corridors for the first time. Groff said the federal funding cancellation caused about a 7 to 8 month delay. Arizona was among 17 states and jurisdictions that challenged the freeze in federal court, arguing the administration lacked the authority to withhold funds already appropriated by Congress. U.S. District Judge Tana Lynn agreed in June, ruling that the federal funding suspension exceeded executive authority. The court restored funding to 14 states, including Arizona. So that's a little bit of an update, folks, on Arizona's EV charging network is moving forward. Now, to the University of Arizona. UA is part of researching solutions to Arizona's water future. University of Arizona researchers are looking for ways to protect the state's water future, including plans to treat and desalinate wastewater for new use through a reverse osmosis system spearheaded by the UA Water and Energy Sustainable Technology Center. We really need solutions to manage the water cycle to make sure that there is more available potable water in many places, said chemical and environmental engineer Andrea Achille, the center's deputy director. Since the start of this year, the state's drought conditions have worsened. About 60% of southern Arizona is experiencing the second most severe level of drought, facing frequent water shortages and serious crop and pasture loss. Roughly 6.4 million of the state's 7.5 million residents are living in areas of drought. The West, that's capital W-E-S-T, the West Center's primary focus is on treating wastewater for new use. With funding from the U.S. Army Engineer Research and Development Center, West has developed a potable water reuse system. The UA is in year two of a four-year, $38 million water reuse consortium with the University of Southern California and the University of Nevada, Reno. The consortium is working to advance water purification and reuse technologies to come up with solutions for water sustainability. The West Center receives $10 million of the project's funding from the ERDC, where the research is dedicated to sustainable brine management, improved virus detection, smart treatment systems, and public engagement to water reuse. The team at the West Center is extremely good at detecting viruses, said Achille, the project's principal investigator. We, as engineers, make sure our processes work as intended to remove viruses and pathogens like chemicals, too. The water reuse processes that West employs could reduce the amount of water Arizona takes from natural resources like the Colorado River and Lake Mead. The state gets 36% of its water from the Colorado River, and since August has seen its withdrawals of the river water cut. These cuts are expected to continue, according to Achille. Arizona is the first in line to be out, or to be cut, rather, from the water we rely on from the Colorado River. And a couple of years ago, Arizona had to diminish their withdrawal from Lake Mead, Achille said. Arizona is part of the Colorado River Project, along with Colorado, Wyoming, New Mexico, Nevada, and California. So let's move on to a couple of other local news stories. Widow fights sale of gun that killed Phoenix officer. She assumed the gun used to kill her Phoenix police officer husband had been destroyed. Then she found out that not only was it still in the department's custody, but it would likely be sold at auction. Julie Erfel, that's E-R-F-L-E, Erfel. Julie Erfel has filed a lawsuit looking to stop the sale of the weapon that killed her husband, Officer Nick Erfel. Erfel said she sees no reason why that gun should be sold and put back on the streets. This is so much more than a weapon, in my view. This was the object that did violence to my husband's body. The lawsuit filed October 14th in Maricopa County Superior Court argued that the planned auction of the murder weapon violated her rights as a crime victim. Julie Erfel said the city and police department were violating a provision of the enshrined in the Arizona Constitution by voters, known as the Victim's Bill of Rights, the lawsuit said. Among its provisions was one saying a victim should be treated with fairness, respect, and dignity. In our last piece in the local news this morning, community walks aim to protect immigrants. A group of volunteers is going door to door in Tucson neighborhoods to spread information about immigrants' legal rights. The Barrio Walks Committee is a collective of community volunteers and members of the Party of Socialism and Liberation who visited different neighborhoods every month to inform immigrants of their rights. The walks began in mid-February. Aurora Ramirez is a member of the committee. She said they have focused on visiting communities on Tucson South Side near South 12th Avenue and West Valencia Road. We found that it was really important for us to pass out Know Your Rights information, Ramirez said. But it wasn't just so much about passing out the information, it was also about organizing our community. So once a month, the Barrio Walks Committee invites about 50 community volunteers to assist with the walk. The organization leads with a 15-minute political discussion, then divides walkers into groups. Each includes one person with prior experience and one person who speaks Spanish. So that's the local news this morning from the Arizona Daily Star. We open with the Arizona's EV charging network moving forward. The UA is part of researching solutions to Arizona's water future. We looked at an article about a widow facing the sale of a gun at auction that killed her police officer husband. And then finally, community walks aimed to protect immigrants. Let's go ahead and move on now to the business section of the Star, and that's over on page 14, and we're almost there. Here it is, coming into focus. Page 14, the business section of the Star, and it opens with an article on electronic waste, or e-waste as it's called, and it says, e-waste from U.S. pollutes Southeast Asia. It has a couple of pictures showing Thai officials, and they're displaying samples of illegally imported electronic waste from the United States, which they said they seized at Bangkok port during a press conference in Bangkok, Thailand, May 14th. And then also another picture of an e-waste collector uses a cleaver to remove copper wire from a device in Nhat Tao Market, the largest informal recycling market in Ho Chi Minh City, Vietnam. And that picture was snapped on January 31st, 2024. So millions of tons of discarded electronics from the United States are being shipped overseas, much of it to developing countries in Southeast Asia, unprepared to safely handle hazardous waste. according to a new report by the environmental watchdog. Seattle-based Basal Action Network, or BAN, as it's called, B-A-N, said last week that a two-year investigation found at least 10 U.S. companies exporting used electronics to Asia and the Middle East in what it says is a hidden tsunami of electronic waste. This new, almost invisible tsunami of e-waste is taking place, padding already lucrative profit margins of the electronics recycling sector while allowing a major portion of the American public's and corporate IT equipment to be surreptitiously exported to and processed under harmful conditions in Southeast Asia. Electronic waste, or e-waste as it's called, includes discarded devices like phones and computers containing both valuable materials and toxic materials like lead, cadmium, and mercury. As gadgets are replaced faster, global e-waste is increasing and growing five times quicker than it is formally recycled. The world produced a record 62 million metric tons in 2022. That's expected to climb to 82 million tons by 2030, according to the United Nations International Telecommunication Union and its research arm, the UNITAR, UNITAR. The American e-waste adds to the burden for Asia, which already produces nearly half of the world's total e-waste. Much of it is dumped in landfills, leaching toxic chemicals into the environment. Some ends up in informal scrapyards where workers burn or dismantle devices by hand, often without protection, releasing toxic fumes and scrap. So that's some unfortunate news in the business section this morning. E-waste from U.S. is polluting Southeast Asia. Now let's move on to our second of two stories in the business section. Cryptocurrency ATMs in gas stations, grocery stores, are magnets for fraud. What's that about? Well, last year, Melissa McKee, or it might be McKay, it's capital M-C, capital K-E-I, McKee, wired Isanti County Sheriff Sergeant Tom Leatham as much money as she could get her hands on in a day. She thought paying $2,000 through cryptocurrency kiosks in a gas station and at a currency exchange would satisfy two arrest warrants issued for failing to appear in court as a juror in a federal murder trial, sparing her a three-week stint in jail. But it turned out that there was no case against her, no warrant, no Sergeant Leatham. It was all a scam designed to play on her own fears and emotions to coerce her into depositing thousands of dollars into a cryptocurrency automated teller machine, or ATM, money she would never see again. The crypto ATM is fast becoming the hottest tech tool in elaborate fraud schemes that many local police departments are unequipped to solve. The machines resemble traditional ATMs, but instead of dispensing cash, most allow only users to put in cash for the purpose of buying cryptocurrency, like Bitcoin, on an exchange. The machines, often placed in gas stations, liquor stores, and supermarkets, allow fraudsters to convince people like McKee to deposit cash into internet-based cryptocurrency accounts outside traditional banks, making the money nearly impossible to trace or recover. Desperate to stop eye-watering financial losses, which topped $200 million last year nationwide, state and local officials have taken steps to regulate or even ban the cryptocurrency kiosks themselves to stem the tide of financial fraud. The Minnesota legislature adopted new requirements for the machines last year. Brooklyn Park, Forest Lake, St. Paul, and Stillwater are all among cities where patterns of fraud are prompting leaders to consider regulating cryptocurrency kiosks at the local level. Stillwater banned the machines in April, drawing a lawsuit from industry leader Bitcoin Depot, which claims to be the nation's biggest cryptocurrency machine operator. The Atlanta-based company has more than 8,500 machines spread across the U.S. Skeptical government officials question why cryptocurrency kiosks need to exist, given that savvy users can buy cryptocurrency through cheaper, more convenient means, like on a smartphone app or a home computer. So there you have some information on cryptocurrency. ATMs and gas stations and grocery stores are magnets for fraud. That's a good cautionary note. And then finally, in the business section, e-waste from U.S. is polluting Southeast Asia, unfortunately. All right, let's go on to the nation and the world. And that's way down on page 30 this morning of the Arizona Daily Star. And if you're just joining us, I'm Steve, a volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona. I'm reading the Arizona Daily Star for today, the 28th of October, 2025. So now to the nation and world section of the Star. And the front page story, the big front page story, is about redistricting, specifically Indiana to take up maps. The governor called special session to redraw congressional districts. The Republican governor of Indiana said Monday he'll schedule a special session to redraw congressional boundaries after weeks of pressure to back President Donald Trump's bid to add more winnable seats with mid-cycle redistricting. Trump pressured Republicans to draw new maps that give the party an easier path to maintain control of the House in the midterms, while Republicans in Texas, Missouri, and North Carolina moved quickly to enact new districts. Indiana lawmakers have been hesitant. Republican Governor Mike Brown, that's B-A-B-R-A-U-N, Braun, called for the General Assembly to convene November 3rd for the special session. It's unclear whether enough of the GOP majority Senate will back new maps. Vice President J.D. Vance first met with Brown and legislative leaders in Indianapolis in August, and Trump met privately with State House Speaker Todd Huston and State Senate President Pro Tem Roderick Bray in the Oval Office weeks later. Vance also spoke to state lawmakers visiting Washington that day. Vance returned to Indianapolis on October 10th to meet with the governor as well as the Republican State House and Senate members. The legislative leaders kept their cards close as speculation swirled over whether the state, known for its more measured approach to Republican politics, would answer the redistricting call. Brown is a staunch ally of Trump in a state the president won by 19 percentage points in 2024. But Indiana lawmakers have avoided the national spotlight in recent years, especially after a 2022 special session that yielded a strict abortion ban. Brown previously said he did not want to call a special session until he was sure lawmakers would back a new map. I am calling a special legislative session to protect Hoosiers from efforts in other states that seek to diminish their voice in Washington and ensure their representation in Congress is fair, Brown said in a statement Monday. Typically, states redraw boundaries of congressional districts every 10 years after the census has concluded. Opponents are expected to challenge any new maps in court. State lawmakers have the sole power to draw maps in Indiana, where Republicans hold a supermajority in both chambers. Democrats could not stop a special session by refusing to attend, as their peers in Texas briefly did. A spokesperson for Bray said last week that the Indiana Senate lacked the votes to pass a new congressional map, and she said Monday that the votes are still lacking, casting doubt on whether a special session will achieve Brown's goals. So that's a bit of information on Indiana to take up redistricting. Let's now go to the Middle East, where there is a picture that looks at Palestinians watching machinery and some workers from Egypt. They're searching for bodies of hostages Monday in Hamad City, and that's in the southern Gaza Strip. So the headline is, Israel says Turkey won't have a role. Search continues for remaining hostages remains in Gaza. Israel will not allow Turkish troops to take part in an international force the United States has proposed to oversee the ceasefire agreement in the Israel-Hamas war in Gaza, Israel's top diplomat said Monday. The 20-point deal brokered by U.S. President Donald Trump this month calls for a force to monitor the ceasefire, but does not mention which countries would provide troops. It says the U.S. would, quote, work with Arab and international partners to develop a temporary international stabilization force, unquote, to deploy in Gaza. The force would train and provide support to vetted Palestinian police forces and will consult with Jordan and Egypt, who have extensive experience in this field. The ceasefire agreement calls for Israeli troops to gradually withdraw from more areas of Gaza as the international force establishes control and stability and as Hamas militants disarm. Speaking to journalists during a visit to Hungary, Israeli Foreign Minister Gideon Sar, that's S-A-A-R, Gideon Sar, said Israel opposes the participation of Turkish troops in Gaza because of President Recep Tayyip Erdogan's longstanding hostility to Israel. Sar said Israel has communicated its stance to U.S. officials. At a summit in Egypt 2 weeks ago, Erdogan was one of four leaders to sign a document outlining Trump's vision for Gaza and regional peace. U.S. officials say there would be no American boots on the ground in Gaza. About 200 U.S. troops are now in Israel working alongside its military and other countries' delegations at a coordination center planning Gaza's stabilization and reconstruction. The first phase of the ceasefire agreement focuses on the release of the remaining hostages in Gaza in exchange for Palestinian prisoners in Israel. Since the ceasefire began October 10th, the remains of 15 hostages have been returned to Israel, which is awaiting the return of 13 more. On Monday, Hamas said it plans to hand over the remains of another hostage in Gaza. In exchange for the returned dead hostages, Israel handed back to Gaza 195 Palestinian bodies, fewer than half of which have been identified. Over the weekend, Egypt deployed a team to help search for the bodies of hostages still in Gaza. That work continued on Monday. So that's the sad story of the war in Gaza this morning. So let's move on to other stories. Authorities detain Brit commentator at airport. Sami Hamdi, that's H-A-M-D-I, Sami Hamdi, a British political commentator, was briefly held on Monday by U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement after ICE officers detained him at San Francisco International Airport, federal officials said. One senior official in the U.S. said the detention was related to comments Hamdi made about the Middle East. Hamdi, who is Muslim, was on a speaking tour in the U.S. and on Saturday addressed the annual gala for the Sacramento, California chapter of the Council on American-Islamic Relations. Earlier this morning, ICE agents abducted British Muslim journalist and political commentator Sami Hamdi at San Francisco Airport, apparently in response to his vocal criticism of the Israeli government during his ongoing speaking tour, the group said in a Sunday social media post. So let's go on to our last big story before we go to the digest this morning in the Nation and World section of the Star. Argentinian leader has big win in midterm vote. Argentina, markets in Argentina rallied. The peso surged and the country's sovereign bonds jumped on Monday as Libertarian President Javier Milei, that's M-I-L-E-I, Milei, hailed his party's resounding victory in midterm congressional elections as a mandate to press forward with radical free market reforms. Investors recovered confidence in the depreciating Argentine peso, and they were dumping in droves last week to hedge against a Milei defeat. The currency surged more than 10% to trade at over $1,300 per dollar on Monday. Argentine stocks soared 20% and bonds set to expire in 2035 climbed more than 10 cents. So there you have it. An Argentinian leader has big win in midterm vote. Now let's go around the world in the digest this morning. Let's see. First of all, Trump would love to serve a third term. President Donald Trump said Monday he would technically be eligible to run for vice president after his current term, but ruled out doing so, telling reporters it, quote, wouldn't be right. At the same time, Trump again declared his interest in serving a third presidential term, which is barred under the Constitution. I would love to do it, he told the journalists traveling with him aboard Air Force One during his multi-leg trip to Asia. The 79-year-old Republican often drops hints about his potential plans for the next presidential election, including campaign-style caps reading, quote, Trump 2028, unquote. This has fueled speculation over whether he might seek a way to extend his political career. And now, the next story, in brief. President seeks okay to fire copyright chief. The Trump administration on Monday asked the Supreme Court to allow it to fire the director of the U.S. Copyright Office. The administration's newest emergency appeal to the high court was filed a month and a half after a federal appeals court in Washington held that the official Shira Perlmutter could not be unilaterally fired. Nearly 4 weeks ago, the full U.S. Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia Circuit refused to reconsider that ruling. Perlmutter is the Register of Copyrights and also advises Congress on copyright issues. The case is the latest that relates to Trump's authority to install his own people at the head of federal agencies. Now in brief, on to Wisconsin. Planned Parenthood of Wisconsin resumed scheduling abortion Monday after nearly a month-long pause due to federal Medicaid funding cuts, saying it no longer fits the definition of a, quote, prohibited entity under a new federal law that took effect this month. And in Turkey, a magnitude 6.1 earthquake shook western Turkey on Monday, causing at least three buildings that were damaged in a previous tremor to collapse, officials said. In Trinidad, Tobago, Venezuela's Vice President Delcy Rodriguez said Monday that energy agreements with Trinidad and Tobago should be canceled over what she described as hostile actions by the island nation. And now to the Kremlin. North Korean Foreign Minister Chan Chun-hui visited the Kremlin on Monday for talks with Russian President Vladimir Putin, which followed last month's meeting between the country's leaders. Putin and Kim Jong-un met in September in Beijing. And finally, a couple of stories from the U.S. In Florida, intense rains that stalled over central Florida unleashed nearly 20 inches of rain in 24 hours, triggering dangerous flash floods Monday that stranded cars and inundated roadways, leaving some closed to traffic. Finally, in California, ExxonMobil Corporation sued the state of California on Friday over a pair of 2023 climate disclosure laws that the company says infringes on its free speech rights, namely by forcing Exxon, in this case, to embrace the message that large companies are uniquely to blame for climate change. So that's the nation and world section of the Star this morning. And now it's time to bear down and move to the sports section of the Star, back here on page 21. And here's what we have this morning on the sports page. Arizona Wildcats football. The Buffs, that's the Colorado Buffaloes specifically. Buffs breakdown. What you need to know. Arizona's upcoming opponent had just 38 rushing yards this past weekend against another opponent. That bodes well for an Arizona defense that has allowed a combined 490 rushing yards in the Wildcats' last two losses. The Wildcats will now face the second-worst rushing offense in the Big 12, and they are the Colorado Buffaloes. Colorado was outrushed 422-38 yards against Utah on Saturday. The Buffaloes also have the worst rushing defense in the Big 12, allowing an average of 217 rushing yards per game. Following a 53-7 loss to Utah on Saturday, the Colorado Buffaloes fall to 3-5 on the season and are in danger of not making the postseason in head coach Deion Sanders' third season in Boulder. Sanders is 16-17. That's 16 wins, 17 losses in 2+ seasons at Colorado. Arizona opens as a 1-touchdown favorite to beat the Buffaloes on Saturday at Folsom Field, according to Action Network. So that's the Buffs breakdown, what you needed to know about the University of Arizona playing the Buffaloes. Now, how about this one? Tucson Roadrunners. This is some ice hockey for all you ice hockey fans out there. Swedish rookie boosts Roadrunners. Tucson Roadrunners rookie forward Noel Nord, that's N-O-R-D-H, Noel Nord, has made himself right at home in Tucson, getting points in three of his last four games. The Söderhamn, Sweden native scored his first AHL goal and got his first assist in Tucson's 5-4 home opener win over the Calgary Wranglers. On Saturday, he scored, that is the new Swede, scored the Roadrunners' goal in their 3-1 loss to the Bakersfield Condors. It's been good. I'm fighting for my first time here like everybody does, Nord said. So, now I'm trying to be better every day and want to show every game what I'm capable to do. So that's Swedish rookie boosts the Tucson Roadrunners. Good luck to the Tucson Roadrunners ice hockey team. And then finally, there's a big story that opens with a picture, and it's called High School Student Athlete of the Week. Double duty, big impact, and it shows a picture of the Student Athlete of the Week, Sunnyside's Anissa Lerma. That's L-E-R-M-A. She's posing for a photo just before the start of the Blue Devils flag football practice, October 22nd. Anissa Lerma setting the standard for Sunnyside flag football. She took a two-year hiatus from playing football, but she missed it dearly. She missed it so much, she kicked off her youth football coaching career alongside her father, Alfredo Lerma, with the Southwest Rams on the south side of Tucson. After her sophomore year at Sunnyside High School, Lerma heard the school was investing in a girls' flag football program and looking to join other Tucson area high schools to compete. Lerma's basketball coach at Sunnyside, Justin Delgado, informed Alfredo Lerma about Sunnyside working toward adding girls' flag football. Once the team was improved, that's how I became the coach at Sunnyside, Lerma said. Now a senior at Sunnyside, Anissa Lerma has become a key person in the Blue Devils' success in year two as a program. Lerma is a quarterback and linebacker for Sunnyside. And congratulations to Anissa Lerma, the High School Student Athlete of the Week. So we just read a little bit about the Buffs. You heard a little bit about ice hockey. And now we wish our High School Student Athlete of the Week, Anissa Lerma, all the best in terms of her work in Sunnyside flag football. Okay, let's move ahead now to the Tucson and Giving section. We'll just go ahead and conclude our broadcast this morning with the Tucson and Giving section of the Star. And it's a nice, uplifting way to end our broadcast this morning. Hermitage celebrates 60 years of cat care. So this is a nice article for all of you cat lovers out there. The Hermitage, or Hermitage, no-kill cat shelter and sanctuary has hit a nonprofit milestone. Specifically, Arizona's first no-kill, no-cage cat shelter and accredited cat sanctuary is turning 60 years old, and it's celebrating with a birthday bash. This should be lots of fun, said Victoria Martell. Victoria is marketing coordinator for the Hermitage. We are hoping to share with people that we are excited to be part of the Tucson community for 60 years. We are a staple in the animal welfare community, but lots of people still don't know we are here, and we want to let them know. And for those who have been supporters, this is a celebration and a thank you, and we still have so much to do. Founded in 1965 by the late Sister Teresa Serafim, a Russian Orthodox nun who retired to Tucson from California and turned her home at 5278 East 21st Street into a refuge, the 9,000-square-foot shelter now houses 357 cats on site. It supports an additional 75 cats through foster homes and adoption partners such as El Jefe Cat Cafe. Sister Teresa Serafin, felt called to take care of animals, Martell said. She felt there was a space to be filled within animal welfare, and she was the person to do it. She accomplished that by recruiting a dedicated force of volunteers who have evolved over the years to remain committed to her philosophy that no cat will be euthanized except in the case of terminal and painful illness or when compassion demands it, barring a reasonable alternative. The shelter houses adoptable kittens, adult and senior cats, and special needs cats with health conditions including urinary tract problems that require special diets, feline leukemia, and feline immunodeficiency virus, otherwise known as FIV. It also offers a permanent residence for cats that are not adoptable. Our goal is to be their home as long as they need us, said Martel. We want them to be as happy and comfortable as possible. Ideally, all the cats in our care would be able to have a home. But we have some sanctuary cats who will be here for life because of behavioral or medical reasons. It would be too stressful for them to be adopted. To make the space as comfortable as possible, long-term supporters facilitated a complete remodel of the home in 2017. They incorporated an administrative office, a medical treatment room, a general population room, a room for cats with feline leukemia, enclosed catios, as they are called, instead of patios, they call them catios, to allow the cats to move freely and safely from indoors to outdoors, and a pet pantry that has distributed more than 25,000 pounds of pet food to pet owners in need this year. So, if you go, Hermitage No Kill Cat Shelter and Sanctuary 60th Birthday Bash, when it is 4:30 p.m., that's the reception, then 5:30 p.m. dinner on Saturday, November 16th. That time again, 5:30 p.m. for dinner and 4:30 p.m. for reception on Saturday, November 16th. Where is the Hermitage? The actual celebration is going to be at the Savoy Opera House. That's 6541 Tanca Verde Road at the Savoy Opera House, 6541 East Tanca Verde Road. The cost is $100 per person. Sponsorships are also available. Registration closes on Friday, October 31st. Festivities include dinner, a silent auction, and stories about the shelter's past, present, and future. And if you're interested, you should go to the Hermitage website to get information. Our goal is to be their home as long as they need us. We want them to be happy and comfortable as possible. And that's the statement and goal by Victoria Martel, the marketing coordinator for Hermitage. Well, that about does it for me, folks. I'm Steve, a volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona. I was bringing you the Arizona Daily Star for today, the 28th of October 2025. Thanks so much for the privilege of your time today. I am now wishing you the best of goodbyes.